Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we will discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight to how it affects our national deterrence. The view of the hosts and guests are their own. We hope you enjoy the show.
Welcome, everyone, to the NIDS View, produced by the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, which is a production of the NIDS Podcasting Network, where we're advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. In this episode, we take a practical look at the recently published 2025 National Security Strategy and dissect a few areas, including how deterrence is to be achieved, how nuclear weapons fit into the strategy, and a little bit about my favorite topic, how education fits into a sustainable future for peace and prosperity. And just as a reminder to our audience, NIDS just put out a proposed nuclear posture review just ahead of this. We didn't know it was coming out, but we went ahead and beat everyone to the punch by putting out a proposed nuclear posture review for people to consider called Peace Through Strength, Renewing America's Nuclear Deterrent. And that can be found on our website at thinkdeterrence.com. And I suggest you go out and read it. It was a great product. I really enjoyed working on it. And we've been getting some comments back, and we really appreciate those comments because they help us to understand what our think tank is supposed to be doing, which is making you think deterrence. So today, as usual, I'm again joined by my colleague and friend, Curtis McGiffin, the Vice President for Education. And he's coming to us live from Tennessee in the United States of America. So how are things going down south there, Curtis?
It's actually pretty cold. I'm standing here in my hoodie, and it's just a bit of cold morning. For us here in the deep south, it is cold. So
like all the way down to 60 degrees for you?
Oh no, it's like 30 something. I mean, it's cold. And, you know, we've all acclimated to the warmer weather anyway. So I do miss the Ohio winters. I have to say.
Well, come back this weekend because we're supposed to have like 2 degrees on Monday. So you might
maybe not
gain your interest in Tennessee. That's great. No, last week I talked about the bomb cyclone, and now we're going to get a multiple vortex, polar vortex, whatever. It's starting to make me feel like I'm back in Alaska again.
Uh-oh.
So I'm really enjoying that. So, all right, well, let's go ahead and get to the topic. You know, I just want to remind everyone the views of the host and the guest are their own. And before we dive in to the important thing, which is the 2025 National Security Strategy, I want to make a public service announcement to the scientists and engineers out there. Because in the show prep, Curtis, I started talking about the National Security Strategy. And I said, you know, what's interesting to me is until I became a member of NIDS, I'll admit, I never read the National Security Strategy. I was a technology guy, even though I was working, strategic systems and working with high level folks, I never really read the National Security Strategy or the Nuclear Posture Review because I don't know. I was a dork, I guess. But anyway, my point is don't be a dork. If you're a scientist and engineer, you should read these because they do set the tone and set the policy for what we're going to, what we're going to do as a nation. And it drives the direction we go. So I suggest that all of you out there take a look at this. And we'll talk a little bit about this this new national security strategy. So I'm going to turn it over to Curtis, who has a better history of understanding how these things go about and the details about it. I'm sure he's got some comments to make. So on to you, Curtis. Go ahead.
Well, Jim, I will also say that as a young aviator 30 years ago flying my airplane, I didn't read the National Security Strategy either. It was never directed or coached to me as a young officer to do that. So I will issue the same encouragement to our young officers and airmen and soldiers and sailors and Marines and Guardians and Coasties and everything in between.
Civilians.
Yes. Federal civilians. Read these documents because they really govern what we're doing. And the National Security Strategy, Jim, is the closest thing we have as a nation to a grand strategy. And this is really the principal document that is required by law to be produced within the first year of the administration. So the Trump administration is just slipping it in under the wire here. And to sort of give direction, where is the country going? What is the president's vision for the direction of the country during his or her tenure as president. And this is the audience for these kinds of documents, ironically, really aren't the American people because they don't read these things. The audience, is really, Congress, allies, adversaries, and to some degree, the policy administrators within the bureaucracy that is the United States government. And it is supposed to be sort of the seminal guidance as to where we are going, what we should have to get there, the ends, ways, and means of grand strategy. And this document tries to organize itself into that manner. But what it's a short document. It's about half the size of President Trump's 2017 national security strategy, which when I teach grand strategy at the graduate level, and I always show to my students or sort of explain to my students that the 2017 national security strategy is perhaps, they're all imperfect, but perhaps is the best one of all of the post-Cold War presidents attempting to do a national security strategy that is something more than just a list of aspirations and good intentions, right? And so this one, in my opinion, doesn't quite measure up, but it is interesting. But what I find most interesting are all of the commentary coming out from the Washington intelligentsia, sort of poo-pooing this document, how bad it is and these sorts of things. And so I just want to remind people, I have a short commentary. I don't normally do this, Jim, so I appreciate you indulging me. I'm going to kind of read from this little commentary I wrote today, to sort of wrap this up and maybe this will give some reason.
Do we have some nice music to play behind?
I don't think so. I don't really think you need it.
Okay.
But we'll go anyway. You can imagine something in your hair, but I'll try to get through this quickly here. So, you know, from 1992 to 2024, U.S. foreign policy has often resembled an overcaffeinated concert roadie on a world tour without a map, a budget, or a group chat to keep his partners updated. Washington spent the 1990s assuming that history and realism were over, eagerly accepting the title of prime superpower and pursued market liberalization and sought to enforce a stable world order. The 2000s showed that the world had not integrated as hoped, and we couldn't understand or accept that parts of the world opposed American primacy. The 2010s were spent improvising through great power competition like a student who'd forgotten their presentation was scheduled for today. The Iraq War became the world's most expensive oops, and Afghanistan turned into a two-decade reminder to read the fine print on nation building. Together, the overreach of global war on terror and the attempt to liberalize Baghdad and Kabul cost American taxpayers over $5.8 trillion, according to a comprehensive study at Brown University. Policy towards Russia and China swung between strategic partner, competitor, and acute or pacing threat with dizzying speed. By the early 2020s, allies and adversaries alike were unsure whether the U.S. was leading from behind, pivoting, retrenching, or merely buffering. Ultimately, hope was too often mistaken for optimism. Policymakers hoped that the post-Cold War would liberalize the world smoothly, that interventions would be brief, that rivals would become responsible stakeholders, and that globalization would civilize everyone. But too often, this hope morphed into unearned optimism, used as a substitute for strategy rather than a motivation for it. The result was a foreign policy built on wishful trajectories rather than sober assessments, leaving the U.S. surprised and frequently stuck holding the geoeconomic bag when the world declined to follow its script. 30 years of American traditional economic internationalism and military interventionism policies have strained the U.S. social fabric and led to an untenable national debt, rising from $5 trillion in 1995 to $38 trillion in 2024. Moreover, the result was an erosion of deterrence, free-riding alliances, an aggressive, powerful, and motivated axis of autocracies willing to invade neighbors, annex international waters, and actively challenge the rules, the Western-based, rules-based international order. Western-led, sorry. This diffusion of global power, enabled by strategic patience, has challenged the U.S.'s ability to shape outcomes on its own. Thus, a policy reset is in order. This NSS appears to remedy for 30 years of diminished American power and influence. It emerges from the shadows of traditional Washington, D.C. statists whose, quote, "this is the way we've always done this," unquote, mantra has helped create the dangerously complex world we live in now. Arsonists cannot be the firefighters. The cost of business as usual is now unaffordable, geopolitically, geographically, economically, and militarily. And so those are my initial thoughts here, Jim, as we think about the naysayers on the Trump administration's 2025 national security strategy. There is this standard sort of idea, right? This expected rejection from the DC intelligentsia, who are booing this NSS and its America First policies, or what I would call Trumpism. Those who reject this strategy fundamentally believe that traditional American foreign policy will work if only we could spend more money, spread more democracy, and have a different president. What are your thoughts on that, Jim?
Well, let me start out. There are a lot of things here. First of all, Curtis, obviously, I didn't prepare my own monologue. And I noticed in your monologue.
Amateur.
Yeah, I know. Well, and even though I have a PhD, you used a lot of really big words in your monologue. I have to look up. But that's okay. I'll get to those later on for our audience. You'll have to look them up, too. So I'm gonna cipher your whole monologue down into one comment made by Yogi Berra, and that is, the future is not what it used to be. You know, we can look at that, many different ways, but I think it's time to come to realization that things that you know, from the past hadn't worked. And so I want to get back to, connect this to the national security strategy.
Right.
But I do have to give a personal note here. Your comment about not preparing for an exam the next day just brought back this. For those out there with a PhD, you know what I'm talking about. I still wake up 30 years later, wake up in the middle of the night from a dream that I had. I wasn't prepared for a class, and I spent the whole night in, cold sweat. And then I wake up and go, oh, yeah, that's long past. It never ends for us. So that's just a, psychological problem for us. So, yeah, good for me. Okay, so let's talk. Let's talk about it. So first of all, I appreciate your monologue, and I think it's dead on to look at this national security strategy this way. One, you'll never get the perfect national security strategy for two reasons. One, we're humans; we make mistakes. Perfection's not there. But overall, you got to look at it completely. You can pick and choose what you want to fight for or not fight for, and that's why we have a democratic republic. It's why we have different views. But someone's got to take the role, and being in a leadership position, you have to make some decisions that are hard decisions, and sometimes. Sometimes not everything's going to fit in everyone's boat. So thinking we want a perfect national security strategy is, way out there. Plus, we're human beings, and the minute it gets published, the world can change.
That's right.
On that dime. So, I always dislike that when people grab at something, they go, well, it's not perfect because it has this one flaw. Yeah, well, welcome to being human. Okay. And, unlike you, Curtis, I know you only have one flaw. Some of us have many. So being the guy that doesn't have the grand history that Curtis has, I actually went back and looked at previous national security strategies for some other reasons that I thought of as I was looking at this. And the first, I think, that's important in this document that I really liked is it's readable. Unlike Curtis's monologue with the big words that I have to go looking up, it actually, although written for Congress, it's understandable. whether you agree with everything is another piece, but very understandable by a lay person. I mean, I really like the very opening chapter, beyond, I'm not going to get into the president's message up front is very typical Trump talking about how, the things he's done. But when you start out, it defines strategy and why we have to have a strategy and why it's important to them. And it's defined there for everyone. So it puts out the purpose. And as, a scientist, I always tell people, define your terms up front. You're going to call me something or you're going to say something is this way or that. Define what that means up front, because otherwise, everything else can go awry. So I thought it was very well written in that way from beginning to end. Everything is clean, using words that even Petrosky can understand, and but ideas that you can at least say make sense and I follow it. So that's the first piece. I think the second piece that I do think is really important here is that in the national security strategy, a lot of what occurs with regard to international relations is established through a concept that's laid out very early in the strategy, which is sovereignty and economic strength are important for us, but for countries in general. Countries are sovereign nations. We're not there to bull a country around. We're just there to keep you from letting your bullying around interfere with our national sovereignty as well. And I thought that came out very clearly, which is completely different from either the other two I looked at. Either the other two. We said, we're going to do this, we're going to do this. These are all based on, I look at Europe, helping Europe to regain, economic and civilizational confidence, gaining stability, in Asia, rebalancing in Asia. I thought that was a great piece of this strategy. Reasserting the Monroe Doctrine as the Trump corollary, I think was listed there. But basically looking at our hemisphere, really laying these things out in very practical terms. I understand the jab and I understand why there's a lot of talk about the Middle East, but basically looking at the Middle East and strengthening alliances, I think that's important. You've got to have alliances to make things work. Doesn't mean you give up your sovereignty. So I thought these things here in the history for establishing world order was really important in this national strategy. And I hope it continues because it's what we need if we want to maintain, as NIDS wants to do, maintain peace and prosperity through, and we'll get to the big guns. I'll let Curtis sort of insert himself here before we go on. Before we get to the big guns, which is the nuclear side of this national security strategy, which I thought was fairly well done in this document. So, the idea of burden sharing, regional stability, looking at, core national interests for everyone, understanding those core national interests, whatever they may be. Now, if your core national interest is to destroy us, well, that now there's the conflict and we need to find a way to resolve that. But it is in some ways, if you read this, you read that into that document very well. Curtis, I'm going to let you have an opinion before I move it to the nuclear side of this, which I think is really important.
Yeah. So, obviously every country has core national interests, and it's when our core national interests collide with another state's core national interests that you have the potential for conflict. That's how it works, that's where that is. My read of the National Security Strategy, the NSS here, is that it's really broken down into. I know you love it when I do this, Jim, which is I break it down to the four P's. Of the National Security Strategy. This is different four P's.
Oh, no.
Let's not confuse it with the four P's of resilience. This is the four P's of the NSS, and it breaks down to people, product, preservation, and peace. These are the ultimate goals here. And when we talk about this very quickly, people, this strategy highlights protecting the American citizenry, our constitutional system, personal liberty, and a sufficiently prepared workforce necessary to reshore industry and the overall way of life, right? The American way of life. So that's the people side of this. On the second one here, product, the NSS really frames it in terms of trade balances, right? The ultimately speaks to safeguarding the industries of America, its goods, products, and services that are made in America, and power its economic strength and resilience. It also also highlights the need for energy and mineral dominance because, as you know, Jim, as I've preached a number of times here, economic security equals national security.
Preach
your energy. Energy security equals national security. So these things are all interconnected. The third one, preservation, this really captures security and sovereignty, right? The NSS's overarching aim to protecting national interest, deterring war, and defending U.S. territory and sovereignty. There's a quote here from page 3 of the National Security Strategy, quote, "We want the world's most robust, credible, and modern nuclear deterrent, plus next generation missile defenses, including a golden dome for the American homeland, to protect the American people, American assets overseas, and American allies." So you start seeing how these P's are all integrated together. The fourth one is peace. The president views himself, there's even a quote in here on the same page, that he is the president of peace. Trump seeks to cajole peace through cooperation, peace through economic transaction, and peace through strength. And being perceived as a recognized peacemaker rather than a coercive peacekeeper seems to enhance U.S. soft power and perhaps attract and realign peripheral nations into a more friendly orbit. This is sort of the goal here of this NSS. And so when you take all these pillars together, it reflects a strategy that is really centered on securing the nation's foundations, its economic engine, and of course, its sovereign and freedom of action. And so I really think that to that degree, at least at the very high level, this NSS is quite successful at doing that.
Yeah. And let me just go into that peace, you know, is not done by just simply relenting. I mean, you can have peace by just simply saying, whatever you want, Curtis.
That's called surrender.
It's not what we've done. And I think that realization is built into this document, which I thought was very, very good. And we'll get to, you know, for everyone, this isn't a love fest here. There's some things that we'll talk about later on that I think could be shored up in this document. But I will say putting the nuclear role as part of deterrence in this document says a lot. You know, it says, you know, as you said, the world's most robust, credible, modern nuclear deterrent. Okay. Foundational to national security. Mm-hmm. Okay. The idea is, and I'm going to be doing a series of NIDS knowledges on our other podcast on some of these, what I call serendipities. You know, you build something that's so good, that has such great influence that you use it to influence, or, you know, when I say use it, deploy it, of course. We don't want to use our nuclear weapons, but we need to have them in order that we would not need to use them. Now, there are other reasons for that. And it's so complex that it's so simple, in my opinion. The other piece is, you mentioned the missile defense. I just want to go through, but the idea is, the strategy, maintaining a nuclear arsenal, but also maintaining the capability. This is one of the things that happened, I think, with globalization, as Curtis was talking about earlier in history, is globalization's good, but if you are solely dependent on your military during a time of crisis, on external countries providing you with essentials, industries. I mean, think about the amount of industry that we had to spin up in World War II. Mm-hmm. The industries need to be indigenous in some fashion, in some capability within the United States, so we can use that innovation, that innovative spirit, that ability to build it up. And I see that in this document, looking at, not in isolation for the nuclear work, incorporating AI, quantum computing, autonomous systems, other systems, so that we have a broad set of tools to bring to the nation. Again, if we go to a fight, but that's not the idea. The idea is the adversary is so fearful or so unsure of being successful, they just don't try it. That's the idea. Mm-hmm, okay. Mm-hmm. And it comes across. Lastly, I want to just highlight again, reviving the U.S. defense industrial base. And I know I call it the military industrial complex. And I know, Curtis said in our last podcast, you'd read, he's like, you can't say that because it has bad connotations. Well, I don't give a hoot. We're on a podcast. I don't give a hoot because the reality is it is the military industrial complex. And if it has a bad connotation, get over it, because what it is what it is. Military and industry working together so that we have the best, most capable, most innovative, and most flexible systems on the planet to be able to let an adversary know that, you know, don't tangle with us. And then your sovereignty, as long as it doesn't cross our paths, have your sovereignty, but we have ours.
I'm with you, and I was particularly, so, you know, we're talking about sort of the pros and the cons on this thing, right? So I was particularly happy with some of the very skosh language. I mean, it's an NSS. It's not a national defense strategy on its reference to nuclear deterrence and the quote I read you earlier. Yeah. So I was particularly satisfied by that. It was interesting that that not noted in this NSS, at least from what I could find, was any references to disarmament or any of these things that the president has made in the past, where he said, you know, it'd be good if we just got rid of these missiles, these weapon systems, right? They're blowing up the world and all that. We've critiqued this. But then he also doesn't address in this document either the call for testing. So it's probably a product that this document was probably written prior to those comments. And had this document come out 3 months from now, they'd probably be in there too. Addressing it as policy.
I would disagree. I think there's a lot of ambiguity here.
There's a lot of ambiguity, but there's also a lot of clarity. Yeah. And so on the ambiguity side, I'm disappointed that the tone of the NSS does not really call out China and Russia for the impact, the negative impact on the world that they have had. I mean, it isn't to say that there's none. There are certainly a few good lines in here. And those are definitely worth noting, and if I can find this one very quickly, that I think is worth noting.
It was the one on Asia, was it not?
There was one here where it said that President there's a quote in here that President Trump single-handedly reversed more than three decades of mistaken American assumptions about China, namely that by opening our markets to China, encouraging American business to invest in China and outsourcing or our manufacturing to China, we would facilitate China's entry into the so-called rules-based international order. Mm-hmm. This did not happen. It's about as sobering a statement as we can find. After 30 years, can we finally say whether you were a pro-Trump person or an anti-Trump person, can you at least agree that this has not happened? So I think that there is not a more sobering, realistic effect in here or statement in here. But I'm still a little disappointed that there's not more out there. There's a sort of new Monroe Doctrine that's sort of revitalized in this document. Mm-hmm. I think that's pretty interesting. We do need to pay some attention to our backyard. We have not. But I'll find it interesting that the document does not address any of the recent squabbles we've had with Canada. And as a goal to try to get those things solved. I think it's difficult for us to think about fixing the Western Hemisphere, or our own hemisphere, so to speak, North and South America, if we're not going to address some of the disagreements we have with our northern neighbors, as well as dealing with what is clearly some real challenges with some coercive governments in Latin America and Chinese influence, need to be purged.
Yeah, I do think that we have failed to really discuss that from a national security standpoint. You always look at it almost as a law enforcement issue. And it's not because of the way the America and our citizens and our industries and our security is being used as a tool to bring us, make us weaker on the global front.
Are you talking about narcotics?
Yes. Okay. Narcotics. I'm also, narcotics. What's the word I'm thinking of? Spying. encompassing like spying, stealing, trade
espionage.
Secrets, you know, all espionage. Thank you. That's the word I was thinking. Mm-hmm. Again, Curtis knows those big words.
It's a senior moment, Jim. It's okay.
Yeah, well, I'm having a lot of those these days. The espionage aspect of this is really coming to light as we move forward. And so that's an important part of the national security strategy. And I would say one of the things in that section, when we talk about, you know, the regional strategy section, is I think it opens the door, and we are a think tank, to think about what really needs to be done. How can we bore down on that?
Yeah.
An excellent opportunity for writing and podcasts, et cetera, that we should, you know, mm-hmm. take on in the next year as a result of this document coming out, because the details aren't there, unlike what we put into the NPR, proposed NPR, by the way.
Right.
Just like our, you know, because we put the details there for the administration to take a look at. So I think that's great. I do want, you know, we're 30 minutes. I do want to hit one last piece, just because it's my favorite piece. But I you know, and I say that sort of tongue in cheek, but one thing is to set out the 2025 national security strategy, but it's another thing to look at the future. And I know we looked at the future, you know, you can talk about nuclear weapons and say, well, modernization is really a future, you know, it's going to be going on for 60 years or so. It's important now. But I think the future, again, comes back to people. And the people that are doing the work that needs to move forward and such, and that can help shore up our strategy and our standing, are, you know, the people that are doing the work, the people that understand the strategy and the policy and the technology and the interplay between civics and government and global issues. And that comes through an understanding through education, whether it be formal education, whether it be informal education. Everybody that's working every piece of our nation needs to at least understand their part mm-hmm. in it. And so I thought that it came out a little bit. There was some talk about, you know, specifically about STEM. I don't like I know people throw STEM around a lot. I don't like using that word, because to me, a lot of times science gets sort of, you know, becomes this little magic thing that, you know, bling.
Curtis, oh, it's magic. You know, or, it's all magic.
You now have STEM, bling. But it's not that way. It comes through very hard work and very, very focused programs and very focused ideas that need study and understanding from the basics all the way to the advanced pieces here. And so it needs a long term. You don't just do it, you know, let's do STEM education for a year and now we're all STEM'd, whatever that means.
Yeah. Well,
sorry, I got on the diagram.
I mean, to your point, there's a lot of call in the NSS about, you know, developing high tech industry, that we, yes. that America must be the leader, the global leader in all of this high tech. And I'm certainly not poo-pooing any of that. But the point here is that it doesn't come without a cost.
Yes.
And we have to, you have to explain to the American people why they have to pay more in utilities to power AI data centers, why they have to pay more or import more folks or who can do this kind of work or build more schools. But most importantly, we have to be willing to fail. We have to be able to test and fail and learn from that and grow from that and these sorts of things. I still think our culture here in America, we're just still sort of not really there yet in this idea that it's okay to fail. Our government tends to defund you if you're receiving money from them. If you fail, organizations, and I don't know. And the consequence of this is a very slow growth progression. And this is why it's taking us 30 years to modernize the nuclear enterprise, when it's taking our adversaries a quarter of that time to modernize theirs. And I know there's a lot more detail to it, so save your emails. But for the most part, the reality is that we are behind because of our own selves, right? Our own policies, our bureaucracy, and so forth. And that can, we're the only ones who can fix that. So I would call that out. I want to, before we break away, Jim, I want to say one last thing that I think causes a lot of consternation of those who have reviewed this NSS and are having problems with it is sort of the quote unquote treatment of allies. The Eurohawks are essentially saying, this is all but an abandonment of Europe, to letting them fend for themselves. That could be hardly farther from the truth. and that the Pacific folks are being, I don't know, overly influenced, for lack of a better term. And I've heard other naysayers call some of this strategy short-sighted. And I wanted to sort of talk about this for just a moment, and that is that empowering and enabling allies and partners removes imperial perceptions of American behavior. Letting them lead, investing in their capabilities, and treating them as co-architects rather than subcontractors, right, signals that America, or this and this administration specifically, isn't trying to dominate outcomes, but to share responsibility. Okay. And this is, I think, intrinsically and extrinsically motivating. This creates economic value through burden sharing and arms sales, while fostering an equally shared commitment to security goals and deterrence by those nations that we're working with. I mean, if they're in the region, they have an inherent interest in the success of that piece, of that deterrence, right?
Right.
And they shouldn't just contract it away to us in that sense. And so capacity building is not short-sighted. It is a long-term investment in partnerships that advance the balance of power while not doing it solely on the backs of the American taxpayer. So I think what we have to do is realize that because this administration wants to do business differently, it doesn't mean that we're not going to do the business of security and deterrence.
In our interest.
We're just going to ask them. Yeah, it is in our interest to have allies who are strong and independent and vibrant partners, not subjects. Who rely on us for their requirements and their deterrence and their security. We can't afford that anymore. And so we have to find other ways to do that. And so the idea that we should reject these ideas in order to maintain the failed policies of the past at such great expense, which I have already outlined in my wonderful monologue, is, I think, to our detriment. And so I would say to those naysayers, you really need to determine what is it about this NSS you really don't like.
Yeah, well, we're about to close, but you've really prompted just one small piece of this, because when I read this section in the NSS, I looked at it, and I'm surprised that people are looking at it the other way, as very respectful of our allies.
Yes,
in the following way, you know, we're in a damned if you do, damned if you don't kind of policy. If we don't provide support, then, you know, if we don't provide support, then we're not giving them the opportunity. But if we give them the support, then we're telling them what to do. Like, we can't do both.
That's
okay,
right.
You can't. And respecting them and their ability and acknowledging that they are capable of providing substantial amount of their own sovereignty, their own security, et cetera. Now we're there. There's a promise here that I see in this document that we'll be there. Mm-hmm. But if you told me, Curtis, you know, your farm, it's a little bit insecure here and there. So you just sit down, little boy, and I'm going to come over and tell you how to do it. I go, yeah, good luck. Mm-hmm. Okay. Or me to go, hey, Curtis, you're right. It's a problem. So give me all that you earn for the next year and I'll figure something out. Neither one of those is respectful of me or respectful of you. And here I see that sharing is being very good. And so I see a little bit of that here. Maybe that's we're out of time, but it is a discussion for another time where it's, I don't even, you know, I never even thought of it from an economic standpoint, like, wow, taxpayer to pay for this. It's like, I respect you as a country to take care of yourselves and know what's going on in your region. And, you know, you should respect me to know that I'm not going to leave you, you know, hanging out there because it's in my interest. So, you know, let's work that out. And I think too often people fall into one side, and that's not good. So anyway, Curtis, you know, we're getting into the holiday season. We're going to record a few extra holiday podcasts so that we continue through the holidays. But we're going to pick out some topics, and we're going to kill those topics in our podcast. I'm sorry. We're going to talk about those topics. and
highlight the words matter, Jim.
Yeah, I know. And hopefully there'll be something you can listen to while you're taking your break during the holidays, while you're with your family and friends. It might you know, build some conversation, which is really what we want you to do. We have, you know, bring it to the home, bring it to the, what matters, which is us as a country having this great lifestyle, having this great freedom, having this wonderful way of innovating, developing, and living our lives the way we want to, but in the security of not being at war, of not having to, you know, fight the neighbor next door. That's what it's all about. And so we're hoping that you will find peace and prosperity during this holiday season. And we hope that you will return to us every week to listen to our podcast, The NIDS View, and our other podcast that turns down under the NIDS Knowledge, and you know, and learn and grow and support as much as you can. And so with that, I want to just pass on thanks, Kurt, for a great discussion on the
National Security Strategy.
I thank our donors, our listeners, and all in our audience. So as always, we want you to think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to The NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.
The NIDS Podcasting Network.